Okay, so let us continue where we left off yesterday. So we are looking at these 37 aids to awakening, and they occur in seven sets with different numbers in many of them. So we're now looking at the first set. The first set is on the four right efforts. We're going to continue to look at that, and this next one is an example of how the four right efforts actually work. We have seen that there are four types of effort, and the four types are then the idea of avoiding unwholesome qualities, and then abandoning unwholesome qualities that have already arisen, developing the good wholesome qualities, and then encouraging or preserving the good wholesome qualities. So this coming up now is an example of how this is done for each one of these cases. And these are very standard examples in the sutta. This is what is used throughout. The first one here is the effort to restrain, and this is what is called, known as the sense restraint formula in the suttas, and it is found everywhere. It is part of the gradual training, a significant and crucial, essential part of the practice, really, to awakening, because this is where you purify the mind, this is where you avoid too much desires and ill will, so the mind gets purified, and that is really where you get ready for your meditation practice. So this is an important part of it. This sutta is found in the numerical discourses. The four, as you see, the AN 414, the 14th sutta in the Anguttara four. So this is how it goes. Mendicants, there are these four efforts. What for? The effort to restrain, to give up, to develop, and to preserve. And what mendicants is the effort to restrain? When a mendicant sees a sight with their eyes, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. This particular effort is described by way of the six senses, including the mind being a sense as far as Buddhism is concerned. The first one here is the eyes. I think one of the reasons why the eye is first on this list is because the eye, what we see, is such a very large part of what takes up the mental space and takes up the five senses. The sight of eye is by far the most powerful one, and I think they say about 80% of the time, 80% of our mental capacity as far as the senses is concerned has to do with sight. It is very kind of dominant sense compared to the other ones, and that might be the reason why it is first on this list. So when you see a sight with the eye, and this is pretty much all the time, we're seeing stuff all the time, you don't get caught up in the features and details. This just means any aspect of what you're seeing, whether it is the whole sight or any smaller part of the sight or whatever it is, you don't get caught up in any of what you are, what is coming within your field of vision, so to speak. What does it mean to be caught up? What it means is that you are lingering on that thing. You see something that you find attractive and your mind lingers on that. It means that you're not able to go with the flow. The idea is not to hold on to the past, hold on to what you have seen either through desire or through aversion, but to kind of move on to the next thing. It's like when you watch the breath, you don't want to kind of keep thinking about the previous breath, because if you keep, it's not that, you know, the breath isn't all that exciting, so it's quite easy to do with the breath, but you don't want to keep on thinking about the previous breath, because if you do, you can't be mindful of the breath which is here right now. And it's really the same thing throughout the day. You don't want to keep on thinking about things that you have experienced already because of desire and aversion, but you want to flow on so you're able to react in the appropriate way to the next thing that arises in the mind, whether it's another sight or something you hear or whatever. So The idea here of getting caught up is this idea that you are attracted to, or averse. Aversion here means that you have a negative reaction to something. You don't like it. It doesn't necessarily mean ill will. It just means that you are rejecting something. There's a sight that you don't like, and you, for that reason, you have aversion. It's like the anti-desire, the opposite of desire, the desire to get away from rather than the desire to be attracted to. So you can see how this works, how you kind of how this would be contrary to mindfulness if you have desire and aversion. Of course, what is happening here is that mindfulness is about being in the present moment. You can see how desire always leads to the past, sometimes the future. You kind of stay in the past. And of course, as long as you stay in the past, you haven't given up the past and the future. As I was mentioning on the first night, the idea of meditation is about giving up the past and the future. So desire and aversion is always contrary to this idea of giving up the past and the future. And that's why you try to allow the mind to flow with phenomena rather than kind of getting caught up with things, as it says here. So that is the idea of getting caught up. It's important to be clear about what these little words mean, because then it kind of becomes much more clear what is going on. So, if you leave the faculty of sight unguarded, if you don't have mindfulness, if you don't know what is going on, then that is where desire and aversion starts to arise, and they become overwhelming, it says here, but any kind of desire and aversion is of course negative, and when it becomes overwhelming, that's when it becomes really problematic. It means that you get stuck with those things. So for that reason, we don't leave it unguarded. Instead, we guard the mind or the eye faculty. And guarding it means, in this context, just being mindful of what is going on. You have an awareness of what is happening. You know whether what you see, and you know whether some kind of attraction or aversion is arising. That is the guarding of the mind faculty. You know what's happening. You are there. You're present. You're not kind of half there, half somewhere else. Because if you're not really properly there, then the desire and aversion kind of sneaks up on you, and you're not really able to deal with it. So the first part here is being guarding the thing through mindfulness, and the second part then is to restrain. So first of all, you guard, and then if you see that in this case aversion or desire might arise, you can feel that straight away. You know that this object is either attractive or repulsive, and soon some unwholesome state is going to arise in your mind. You can feel these things, see these things happening if you have enough mindfulness, especially in meditation. Much easier on a retreat like this than it is in daily life, because you have more peace, more stillness, you have a more clarity of what is going on. So this is not just about what happens outside of meditation. A similar kind of thing can also be used in meditation itself. You see your mind getting sidetracked, and you bring it back to the breath again. You see some kind of negative thing being about to arise, so you bring it back to the breath. Or you use some counter method to stop a negative thought from arising here. So the restraining here, what that means is that you have a method for dealing with this. So if you see that your desire is about to arise, you remind yourself of the danger in that desire. Or you remind yourself of you don't really want to go there, because you know it's going to involve you in a bad way. So you understand the problem in the situation. If you understand the problem, your mind will not attach. Of course, understanding the problem is often quite hard. It can be hard to see the problem in these things, especially with desires, with aversion and ill will. It is easier to see the problem because it's so much more obvious what is going on, but it can be quite hard to see the problem. You kind of see a nice car on the street and think, wow, that's a really nice car. See one of these kind of, I don't know, sports cars or whatever. That's only a tiny little desire. It's not really the really bad ones. It's hard to see the desire in the sensual world. One of the kind of the great similes that the Buddha uses, we'll show you later on, the simile of the charcoal pit. And according to this charcoal pit, the sensual world is like a charcoal pit. So whenever you see something nice, whenever you see a beautiful Ferrari coming down the street, are there many Ferraris in Perth? occasionally. You haven't seen a Ferrari recently? Okay, I haven't seen it. I'm sure there must be some Ferraris in Perth. So when you see a Ferrari in Perth, remember charcoal pit. Yeah, charcoal pit. It's quite hard, isn't it? It's kind of, the Buddha's teaching is really contrary to how we think about the world. Whenever you see something nice, attractive like that, that is what the Buddha recommends, or one recommendation. And the way to do that, and the only way that this really works, and it works much better with ill will than it works with the sensual objects in the world, is to understand thoroughly the danger in these things. And there's one sutta where the Buddha talks about this. It's called the Dveda Vitakka Sutta, which I very often read out on these retreats. And the Dveda Vitakka means the twofold thought, the two kinds of thought. And in this sutta, the Buddha divides all his thinking up into two kinds. On the one hand, the thinking that is dangerous and leads to problems. On the other hand, the thinking that is unproblematic. And then he explains to us how he deals. Yeah, this is actually the Buddha's own experience before his awakening on how to deal with the thinking mind. And he says that all he has to do, this is kind of the ideal, is to remind himself that this thought leads to suffering for himself, for others, and for both. And just that simple thought, that this leads to suffering for myself and for others, is enough to abandon the thought just like that. Yeah, so when you see that Ferrari, remember, it leads to suffering, yeah? So when the Ferrari leads to suffering, when you understand that, yeah, then you can give up that interest in that Ferrari, and you kind of have a neutral perception of it. You let it go, you just let it pass by at 200 kilometers an hour, or whatever it is that the Ferraris do. So you don't get caught up in these things. But this is quite hard to do. How do we learn to see the danger in the sensual world in this way? And this is where the kind of the hard work is, to actually remind yourself again and again of these problems. And once you see that, it becomes like charcoal. You pick up a hot charcoal. You don't really understand that the charcoal is hot. So you pick it up, and then you know, oh, that's hot. And then straight away, you let go of it. You don't have to think, should I let go of this charcoal or not? If you think like that, it's too late already. Yeah. So you actually do, it's an automatic reflex reaction. You let go of these things. You don't have to think about it. And it's the same way, if you understand suffering properly with these things, then it's an automatic reflex that you let go of them. This is the ideal way of achieving sensory strength, because it is so easy then. Yeah, all you do is you bring to mind the problem, you bring to mind the suffering that is involved with this, and then the letting go happens, bang, like that, and you are okay as a consequence. So you can see from this that, again, we come back to this idea of the patisankhana bala, the power of reflection. And the power of reflection is ultimately what enables you to let go of things in this way. Because you have to reflect again and again to understand why these things are problematic. And the more you reflect on this, and I'm going to go through this in more details later on. Now it's more like an overview of what is happening. The more you reflect on that, the more you understand why it is a problem, the more you understand how the five senses always let you down. Remember, Ferraris are part of the five sense world, yeah? So Ferraris always let you down at the end of the day. So it always lets you down. And the more you get that the five sense world is problematic in that way, the easier it is to let go of things. It's not that hard to understand, on a superficial level at least, why the five sense world is always problematic. Because we know that every time we attach to something in that world, every time we desire something, we're going to have to pay that back with interest, because it's going to be taken away from us sooner or later. It's very obvious in one sense, but it takes quite a bit of reflection to allow it to sink in more deeply. And that is really the hard part of the practice sometimes. So this is what is meant by restraint again. Remember, I was talking before about the idea of using wisdom power rather than using willpower. And this is also true in terms of restraint. Ideally, it is a practice of wisdom rather than a practice of will. And this is how it happens. So first of all, you have the mindfulness, you see something wrong is happening, and then you have the skillful means to deal with it in the right way. It is not enough just to be mindful. Remember that. Sometimes we tend to raise mindfulness to something that almost seems to have a magical ability on its own. But actually, mindfulness on its own is not all that useful, because if you just have mindfulness, then you see Ferrari, seeing desire, seeing attachment, yeah, and you go on like that, and nothing really happens. So you have to have more than mindfulness. Mindfulness on its own right doesn't overcome the defilement. It can do if it is very strong and you just stay with it in the present moment, because that means that the desire doesn't have a chance to arise at all. But very often mindfulness is not enough. You need a technique, you need a way to deal with the problem, and this is what this is about. It's interesting, in one of the suttas in the Sanghita Nikaya, the Buddha specifically says that mindfulness does not overcome ill will. It is metta, it's loving kindness, it is friendliness that overcomes ill will, not mindfulness. Mindfulness is essential because mindfulness alerts you to the fact that there is a problem, but it's not enough. Yeah, you need a method, you need a way to deal with this, to be able to overcome it. So this is the idea of sense restraint, ideally how it happens. Sometimes you may have to use a little bit of willpower, yeah? I always like to point out to people that if you are about to do something really bad, yeah, if you're just about to kill somebody, then please use a bit of willpower to hold yourself back. Yeah. Otherwise, if you have just mindfulness, then it might be too late. Killing. Yeah. noting the act of killing. Yeah. That's no good. Yeah, we want to avoid the killing altogether. Yeah. So, okay. So that is how, roughly how it works, and that is the idea of sense restraint. And it is the same for all the six sense faculties. When they hear a sound with the ears, when they smell an odor with the nose, when they taste a flavor with the tongue, when they feel a touch with their body, when they know a thought with their mind, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of mind were left unrestrained, bad unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, the practice of restraint, protecting the faculty of mind, they achieve is its restraint. This is called the effort to restrain. So the mind faculty matters as well, because sometimes the desires and aversions, the senses tend to echo in the mind. Yeah, we see something and we think about it afterwards. Or you dream at night, you dream about all the things that you saw during the day. And then desire and aversion can arise even in dreams. Yeah, let alone during the day. You sit in meditation, suddenly things come up in your mind. And it's exactly the same principle that you use when things arise in the mind quite apart from the direct experience of the sense faculties. So same thing again. So there you are. That is the first of the four right efforts, how to do it in practice. So let us go on to the next one. The next one is the effort to give up. So if the sense restraint fails, yeah, and then because of failure of sense restraint, bad unwholesome qualities arise, and often they will. It's just the way life tends to go sometimes. It's hard to avoid it altogether. Then you have to give up the bad quality. And this is how you do that. And what mendicants is the effort to give up? It's when the mendicant doesn't tolerate a sensual, malicious or cruel thought that has arisen, but gives it up, gets rid of it, eliminates it and obliterates it. They don't tolerate any bad, unskillful qualities that have arisen, but give them up, get rid of them, eliminate and obliterate them. This is called the effort to give up. So here we have the standard set of three bad qualities or bad thoughts. And again, these are the sensual thoughts, or I'm not sure if I really like the word sensual, because it gives a kind of wrong slant to what is meant by this. What is meant by this is really any desire for the objects of the five senses. That is really what it refers to. So it's a very broad category. Sensual makes it sound very narrow, but actually it's an incredibly broad category that is really meant by this. So that is karma. Then you have a malicious. So the malicious thoughts here are ill will. Yeah, not necessarily malicious perhaps, but having ill will of some kind, starting from the most tiny irritation all the way up to the kind of greatest rage and the whole kind of specter in between. And then you have vihinsa, cruel thoughts. I don't really like the translation cruel. I apologize, Ajahn Sujata, but I'm not sure if I like that one. Reason is because vihinsa is often a sense of lack of care for other beings. You don't care about what other people feel. You walk down the path and you see that the ants are kind of walking on the path, but you don't really care about whether you stepped on the ants or not, because you have to walk there, and you couldn't be bothered to try to walk around them or something like that. In other words, it's a kind of a cold-heartedness. It's a lack of compassion. And vihinsa is exactly the opposite of compassion. Yeah, the way to overcome vihinsa is actually to develop compassion. Karuna is the opposite of this. So it's not really necessarily cruel, it's just the kind of a lack of care for how you affect other people, and whether other people have suffered because of your actions or not, you couldn't really care less. And that is really the problem here. So it's something like ruthlessness, or coldness, or callousness, or indifference to other people's suffering, or something like that. Whereas cruelty, I think, is too narrow a definition of vihinsa. So these are the main problems here. Yeah, it's interesting that being callous is kind of so high on the scale here. Yeah, cruelty obviously part of that. The idea of not caring about others is actually a bad thought in this sense. It's quite interesting because it may not be obvious, but these are the thoughts that you have to give up. So how do we give them up? And this is the other aspect here, once it has arisen. And the first thing to be aware of is the fact that once something arises, it tends to infect the mind in a way that makes it difficult to give up. Once that desire has taken hold in the mind, once you feel that sense of ill will towards somebody, once it arises, it can be very hard to get rid of. And the reason for that is because once it has arisen, your mind is already distorted. You're no longer able to see clearly what is going on. The desire actually hinders clarity. And because it hinders clarity, because you already have a vested interest in the object, it is actually very difficult to get rid of at that particular point. So the ideal way of dealing with these things is to grab them as soon as possible. As soon as they start to arise, that is really the time to get rid of these kind of thoughts. And sometimes, if you wait too long, all you have to do is kind of endure them and gradually allow them to disappear. Sometimes that's all you can do, because it's just too hard to overcome once it has arisen. The language that is used here is quite interesting. Yeah, the language for how to overcome these things. You don't tolerate it. Yeah, so lack of tolerance is okay sometimes. We shouldn't always be tolerant. Yeah, so it's good to know. Yeah, so tolerance too has, it's the right time and the wrong time to be tolerant. This is the wrong time to be tolerant. So you give it up, you get rid of it, you eliminate it. And the last one is you obliterate it. Anabhavan gameti, you make it go to non-existence. That is the Pali word. It's really kind of, it sounds like you are taking a sledgehammer and kind of pounding these things to smithereens. That's what it sounds like. We have a sledgehammer in the monastery, and sometimes on days, maybe you have a bit of frustration or something, people use the sledgehammer really well, really powerfully. But usually when we're talking about obliterating something, yeah, using the sledgehammer, or using, not the sledgehammer, using the metaphorical sledgehammer, then obviously it sounds like we are using lots of willpower. Yeah, that's what people do when they take the sledgehammer and they really whack away on that concrete or whatever it's trying to get rid of. I sometimes use sledgehammers. It's quite good fun, actually. It's quite nice. It's kind of really powerful stuff. But a lot of willpower is involved because it's heavy. It takes a lot of force. And so this is where we have to be very careful again. What does it actually mean to obliterate something? And what is interesting is that if you try to obliterate a bad thought using willpower, it sounds like that's what we're supposed to do, but actually you cannot obliterate a bad thought using willpower. It is impossible. Because if you use willpower, all you really succeed, usually, is you succeed with suppressing it and holding it down. You don't actually obliterate it. Sometimes using willpower can work in that way, but very often it does not. You just hold it back and then it comes back again. If you want to obliterate something, and this is kind of counterintuitive, if you want to obliterate something, if you want to annihilate something, if you want to blow something completely into smithereens and blow it out of the universe, you have to use wisdom. And the reason is because when you use wisdom, you're actually seeing something from a different angle. Remember, if you have a bad thought arising in your mind, whether it's desire or it is ill will or whatever, it is sustained by the way that you look at that particular object. If you desire something, if you desire a beautiful Ferrari, it's because you see beauty in that Ferrari. But if you stop to see beauty in the Ferrari and you start to see problems in the Ferrari, you start to see the bills, you start to see repair work, you start to see your attachment, you start to see that after a while you get fed up with that Ferrari and you want an even better Ferrari. If you start to remember the impermanence and the problems and the dukkha that arises from these kind of things, then instead of being attracted to it, that initial attraction, that initial beauty, turns instead into neutrality or even aversion towards that object. And that is why the desire is completely obliterated in this way, because you destroy the cause of the attraction that was there in the first place. And this is why wisdom power is so powerful, because it destroys the very cause, the very root of the attraction. And it's exactly the same thing with aversion. You look at somebody and, you know, someone does something for the thousand and the first time. This is very true in family life. You come back, I haven't lived with my family for many, long time now. I don't know how long. When did I leave home? When I went to university? I haven't really lived with them since then. That is about, I don't dare think about how long that is. Yeah, that's a long time ago. This is what happens when you get old. You don't really want to think about the number of years anymore because it's too many years. But it's a long time ago. It's about, you know, over 30, close to 40 years ago now, getting not quite 40, but getting there. And still, you go back, and when you go back, it's like you're the son coming back to the family, and they treat you in exactly the same way they treated you 40 years ago. Things have changed! Don't you understand? It's not the same anymore! Things are different. Actually, they are a bit different. It's not exactly the same. But some of the habits are still there, and some of the problems still re-arise. For this reason, you have to learn to readjust your perspective on people, including your family members, including everyone. And instead of seeing that irritation, seeing the problem, seeing the negativity of the aspect of the situation, you look at people with new eyes. You look at them as conditioned beings. You look even at the people who are closest to you. You understand that they have to be like that. They haven't got much choice. And the more you build up these kind of perceptions, the easier it is to get rid of the that ill will just like that, because you are destroying the very root, the very cause that gives rise to the ill will. This is the right way to give up these kind of thoughts. Very similar to the restraint that we had looked at before. So that is how you obliterate them, because this is how obliteration happens, because they cannot grow without the soil, without the nutriment that allows these things to exist. Take away the nutriment for the defilements, and the defilements just evaporates. And this is really the right way, the ideal way, I should say, to deal with these things. So, and then you have the cruel or the harsh thoughts. The opposite of that is compassion. So you remember compassion. The little ants on the walking path, they want to live. They are just like us. They also want to live. Little ants, little mosquitoes, they all have, for everyone, every creature, their life is dear. And just to trample them and not care about what happens to them is not a good idea. So having that sense of compassion. Sometimes you need to anthropomorphize a little bit. You have to kind of view these little animals almost like little human beings walking there. Walking around, trying to do their best. And when you anthropomorphize, when you kind of understand that they have similar desires to what we have, and they do. It may not look like the ant has a similar desire to what we have, but if you see how hard they work, running around, ants are incredible workers, you know that they must have similar kind of desires. They're trying to get somewhere. They're trying to do something. They're carrying these kind of big, you know, enormous things for the ants. They're bigger than their bodies, running around with them, running, trying to get, build things up, do things. Yeah, aiming for some kind of unknown future, no idea about. And while they're running around, suddenly, bang, they die because we walk onto them. Yeah, we step on them and kill them because we don't care. And they die anyway, regardless of whether we do that or not. Their lives are so utterly meaningless. If you look at the life of an ant, yeah, it seems so meaningless. But for them, it is so meaningful because they run around, they build things up, they do things. And then you realize, actually, our lives are very much like the lives of ants anyway. That's kind of the scary thing, yeah? We run around doing all of these things that seem so purposeful. Just like the ants run around doing things that seem purposeful, we do exactly the same thing. Until one day you come to the Dhamma and you start to realize, wait a minute, maybe there's something more to life. Maybe there's something else that has far more meaning. An aim and a goal that is real. And that is where you start to see things differently. So in a sense, there isn't that much difference between us and ants. And for that reason, you can have more compassion for these little beings. Even mosquitoes. Some people say the most difficult precept to keep is the first one because you can't kill mosquitoes. It's really, really hard not to kill mosquitoes. You can't sleep at night because the mosquito is buzzing around. And all you can think of is how to get rid of that mosquito by any means. Extermination if possible. And that is where we sometimes go wrong. So having compassion is so important. Getting a bit sidetracked there, I apologize for that, with all kind of ideas. But that's part of the fun of being of these suttas. So that is how the obliteration and the elimination of these thoughts happen, ideally. This is the way to do it. So that is how to overcome the negative thinking. And this is probably the most important part of the four right efforts. As I mentioned before, the four right efforts have two sides to them. The overcoming of the unwholesome and the building up of the wholesome thoughts. There's two sides. But the overcoming of the unwholesome is by far the most important of them. Because when it comes to the building up of the wholesome qualities, we are moving usually into the area of meditation already. So again, you can see how these things overlap. Right effort, right meditation, there aren't any clear boundaries. So now we're going to have a look at the development of the third one of these four right efforts. And this is the effort to develop. And this is spoken of here by way of the seven factors of awakening here. And this is how it is taught in this particular, in this case. It's when a mendicant develops the awakening factor of mindfulness. When the mendicant develops the awakening factor of investigation of principles or of dhammas, of maybe of qualities or whatever, develops the awakening factor of energy, develops the awakening factor of rapture, develops the awakening factor of tranquility, develops the awakening factor of immersion. Immersion? Have you heard that before? Anyway, let's carry on. And the awakening factor of equanimity, which rely on seclusion, fading away, and cessation, ripen as letting go. This is called the effort to develop. So this is the effort to develop, which means to give rise to things. This is literally what this is about, giving rise to qualities that do not already exist. This is what this is about. So develop, I'm not sure if it is the ideal translation, but because develop sometimes means to increase something which already exists. But really the point here is to kind of give rise to something which doesn't really exist yet at all sometimes. And there's really the next one, which is about increasing and developing what already exists. But anyway, it doesn't matter. So here you have these seven factors of awakening, and the idea here is to give rise to these things. So how is this done? How do we give rise to these things? The These seven factors, as I mentioned before, they are sequential, and they are conditioned. Each one of these conditions the next one. They are causal in nature, one following after the previous one. And for this reason, the first one is always the most important one. So the first one is the mindfulness factor of awakening here. So how do we develop that? And of course, the way to develop that is what we have seen just before. It is to overcome the unwholesome qualities of mind, to develop the virtue, to develop all of these other things, and to get rid of those things that distract the mind from mindfulness. Mindfulness factor here can be understood in a number of ways, but one way of understanding it is simply as the Satipatthana practices. In other words, doing the breath meditation, and doing the breath meditation relies on that degree of purity of the mind that makes mindfulness possible. You have to have mindfulness first, and then breath meditation becomes possible. And that comes because of right effort, which we have just seen is part, the most important part is to overcome the negative qualities. So that is really what it is about. Yeah. So that shows you what you have to do. A large part of the work that you have to do in your practice is to overcome the negative qualities of the mind. And if you can do that in daily life through ordinary virtue and sila, if you have ordinary virtue and sila already, you are going a fair way to overcome the negative qualities of the mind. And the reason for that is because if you're going to be virtuous, the only way you're going to be able to do that is that gradually you're going to change the way you think about things. Yeah, if you can't kill mosquitoes, if you can't lie ever at all, and all of these things, it actually encourages you subtly, in a subtle way, to change the way you think about these things, because otherwise it is just too difficult to change these things. So much of the work of the path is actually that kind of purification. And also in daily life, the idea of overcoming especially things like anger and these things that take you away from the mindfulness. This is such an important part of it, and that is where mindfulness really starts to arise. But it's not the only way that mindfulness arises. Mindfulness can also arise through contemplation, and we will see later on that one way of doing that is simply to contemplate the suttas. You contemplate the suttas, you recall the teaching, and that recollection of the teaching, because it is connected with reality, thinking of things in the right way, having straight view about how things actually are, again, it tends to abandon the defilements and then leads to all of these positive qualities afterwards. So the awakening factor of mindfulness actually has different meanings. It can mean a number of things depending on how you use it. And this actually is based directly on the suttas. You find that in the suttas itself, themselves. And then, based on that, these other factors of awakening arise. Yeah, investigation of principles, investigation of the qualities of the mind. This is just a continuation of the mindfulness practice. It means that you understand the qualities of the mind, what are good and what are bad qualities. That's really what that means. Dhamma vichaya, vichaya means an investigation. And this is so important in the Dhamma, because very often we are incapable of fully understanding the qualities of our own minds, because they are so subtle. And you may have noticed that you may be meditating, and you may be doing quite well, you feel quite peaceful, and things are going, you know, you're quite happy with what's happening, but you can't get any further. It kind of stops at a certain point. Why does it stop at that particular point? And this is very important. This is actually what this is about. This dhammavicaya is precisely about finding out why the meditation stops at a certain point. And very often it is not obvious, because you cannot see any real defilements. You feel peaceful. Maybe you even have joy in the mind. Yeah, everything feels so pure and bright. And yet somehow it doesn't advance. Why is that? And the reason is that there is still some subtle defilements in the mind that you cannot even see. And that is what you have to uncover by using dhammavicaya, by investigating again and again, by reflecting after your meditation. Yeah, what is it that stopped me from going further? This is how you uncover these things. And this is the purpose of Dhammavicaya. It is very similar to the last of the four Satipatthanas, which is the Dhammanupassana. These things are basically two sides of the same coin. And Dhammanupassana is an investigation into good and bad qualities, especially the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening, understanding how these are caused, how they come into being, and then enabling you to abandon the five hindrances, at the same time developing the seven factors of awakening. We're going to have a look in more detail later on at the seven, at the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening, because they are very important factors to understand on the path of meditation practice. So that is what that is about. So investigate this. I can give you some ideas straight away why your meditation isn't going deeper, because it is usually, it is very obvious, or it's good to have that idea so you know where to look. And the main reason why your meditation stops is because of some attachment. Specifically attachment to the five senses and the body and the will. Yeah, these things. And because that attachment is there, you can only let go so far. And beyond that, it becomes very difficult, precisely because the attachment is holding you back. So then what you have to do is to reflect a little bit on the downside of these things, reflect how they lead to suffering, and reflect on the potential for meditation. And as you do that, gradually you can overcome these hindrances that block you from going further. So that is the investigation of principles. Adan Sujato uses principles for Dhamma, which is okay. You can also call it investigation of mental phenomena, because this is what it is about. It's really about investigating the good and bad qualities of the mind, and so that is how that comes about. And then when you investigate these principles in this way, and you abandon the hindrances fully, then the energy tends to arise as a consequence. And this is the natural energy of the mind. It is not effort. It is different from effort. Effort is padana or vayama in Pali. Energy is virya. Virya is the natural energy of the mind that comes because the defilements are very low. You may have felt that sometimes in meditation practice, if you get a bit of joy and happiness and mindfulness arising, the energy comes at the same time. You feel energized, the mind feels bright and pure, and this is that energy that this is talking about. With that energy comes the rapture. This is how these things arise sequentially, yeah? The rapture comes, is often very closely related to the energy, and then this whole sequence emerges as a consequence, the tranquility, the immersion, and the equanimity. Immersion is straight away, if you see the word immersion in any sutta, there's only one person in the known universe who translates samadhi as immersion. I'm not sure about the unknown universe, but certainly in the known universe, and that is Adan Sujato. So straight away you know, Adan Sujato. Is it a good translation? It's an interesting translation. And that I don't mean that as a put down. It is interesting. It is an alternative way of thinking about the word samadhi. It's interesting because immersion has the idea of being self-contained. Yeah, being kind of immersed in something. You don't go outside of the thing that you are immersed in. And this is very much what samadhi is about. Samadhi is about this self-contained space inside of yourself. The mind doesn't spill out into the five senses, but stays within. So in that sense, the idea of immersion is actually quite nice. The downside of immersion, I think, is that it might be a little bit too, perhaps, intellectual. Yeah, maybe it doesn't really have a very kind of emotional content to it. This is what, at least this is my kind of maybe critique of that term. So this is the nice thing about the word stillness that Ajahn Brahm uses for samadhi, is that it has much more easy to relate to. We know what stillness means, and it has maybe more emotional force to it, and that's what I like about the word stillness. But it is interesting, because when you see different translations of a word, you start to understand more broadly what the word is about. You see different angles, different viewpoints of that word, and then you get more of a feeling for what it is. Concentration is another word that is used. It has been banned by certain people. And And I think for good reasons. But of course, even concentration gets to some of the idea what it is about. The mind is kind of focused in one area. It doesn't spill outside. Yeah, in that sense, there is some truth to the idea of concentration as well. But the downside of concentration, it tends to imply too much willpower, and that is the problem with that. This is like giving you an idea of the difficulties of translating Pali. It is not always easy, because samadhi is a very Indian word. It exists in the Indian context. It exists in connection with the practice of the spiritual path as it already existed in India prior to the Buddha, going back a long, long way. And it talks about specific attainments on the spiritual path. And we just don't have words for this in the English language. It doesn't exist. Doesn't it exist? Maybe no. I don't think it exists. Even though there are experiences that are similar in the Christian tradition, I don't think they really had any words for it apart from unity with God, and that would not be a good translation. Imagine coming tranquility, unity with God, and equanimity. Wait a minute, that would be a shock in the Buddhist text. So you can't. That one is not definitely not allowable. That is even worse than concentration. So don't try that one. So this is how you develop these seven awakening factors, how they arise. And the very interesting part of this is this last part here. It says it relies on seclusion, fading away, cessation, and ripening as letting go. And this is very interesting, because we are here dealing with the meditation practice, really. All of this is about meditation. All of these things happen while you are watching the breath. This is really like a breath meditation, or perhaps some other object, whatever you want to use. But it's really part and parcel of the meditation practice. And you can see here, it relies on seclusion. It's this idea of the importance of seclusion in Buddhism, the idea of going away from the sensory world, going away from your habitual life, and going to somewhere quiet. First of all, you have the kaya viveka, then you get the citta viveka from the kaya viveka. Kaya viveka means seclusion of body, and then citta viveka arises from the seclusion of body. You take yourself away to Jhana Grove, to a little hut in Bodhinyana Monastery, and that is where the kind of is the best possible conditions for meditation to happen. Real meditation here is, he specifically said then, to be rely on that kind of seclusion, which is very interesting, and that is where these things can be expected to happen. But seclusion is not enough. Then you have fading away and cessation. This is viraga and nirodha, and these are important, because for this process to work, for this meditation process to actually have effect, things have to cease as you practice this path. And you will notice that in your own meditation, many of you, perhaps all of you, will have noticed this at least to some extent. Once you start to become peaceful, there are things that have disappeared, or things have at least faded away. What is it that fades away? Well, the disturbances in the mind fade away. All the inner chatter starts to fade away. The senses start to calm down just by closing your eyes. Already things are fading away, because you're not seeing so much anymore. By turning down the light has the same effect. By being peaceful and quiet has the same effect, because your hearing is not so important anymore. So all of these things are fading away. And the deeper you go in your meditation, the more things fade away. Fading away is good. Ceasing is even better. And this whole process happens as a consequence of more things fading away, more things ceasing. And that is really the point here. And when you get to the jhana states, or the samadhi states at the end there, the majority of samsaric existence has already ceased at that particular point. It's all gone. So the process relies on these kind of things. And then it ripens in letting go. Which means that if you keep on doing this, if you keep on attaining samadhi, if you take it all the way to upekkha, that's the equanimity. It does not mean venerable upekkha, it means the equanimity. then the consequence will ultimately be that you let go completely. Ripe and letting go, letting go here means that craving dies down, and you no longer have craving for these things at all. In other words, it's a way of saying awakening, ultimately, it's a way of saying awakening here. Vasagga parinama is the Pali. Vasagga is this word that means letting go. Vasagga is this beautiful word. Vasagga, patinissaga, all of these words mean letting go in so many different ways. It means like generosity. Generosity is one kind of letting go. And it also means letting go in the higher sense of abandoning things in your meditation practice. So this is the power effort to make things happen, make things, develop things in your practice. This is how it happens. And there's a lot more to be said for this, because things like rapture, for example, and energy in the mind, these things can be developed in many different ways by investigating principles or investigating qualities in the right way. And I will talk more about this later on, how to do this. But this has all to do with the anusatis, the recollections on the path. And these anusatis, they actually give rise to these qualities quite specifically here. But we'll get back to that later on. I can't talk in too much detail about every one, because we're going to have to leave a little bit of talking when we actually come to these seven factors of awakening later here. Anyway, so now we come to the last one, which is the effort to preserve. And it goes as follows. And what mendicance is the effort to preserve? It's when the mendicant preserves a meditation subject. That's a fine foundation of immersion. The perception of a skeleton, the worm-infested corpse, the livid corpse, a split-open corpse, and the bloated corpse. This is called the effort to preserve. These are the four right efforts. That's a bit of a letdown, isn't it? This is how you preserve your this is how you preserve things. Remember that this here is in this case, it is definitely just an example, because it talks about a subject that is a fine foundation for immersion. So anything can be a fine foundation for immersion. Doesn't have to be the worm-infested corpse. If that sounds too kind of disgusting, you don't actually have to do that. You can just watch the breath, and the breath can certainly be a very fine foundation for immersion. In fact, the breath meditation is the one that you find throughout the suttas as the main practice that takes you to samadhi. Nothing is more important than the breath meditation as far as samadhi is concerned. Watching the breath is just really satipatthana practice, taking you all the way to samadhi. What is going on here? A meditation subject is a foundation for immersion. Subject here, the Pali word is nimitta. We often pronounce it as nimitta, but really the proper pronunciation is nimitta. It's double T, so it should be nimitta rather than nimitta. But anyway, that's how it is often pronounced. It is interesting, because you will notice that the word nimitta is here used in a very different way from how we normally use it when we talk about meditation practice. Normally when we talk about meditation practice, a nimitta is like a light in the mind, or something that you see that actually gets you very close to the jhana experiences. Yeah, that's how we normally talk about it. But here, this is the sutta we're talking about it. It actually means an object or a subject of meditation practice. Yeah, that's actually what it means in the sutta. So it means any kind of thing that you focus on. Even the breath can be called a nimitta. In fact, the four satipatthanas are called the nimittas of samadhi elsewhere. They are the objects that lead you to samadhi. That's what they are called in the suttas. And here it is just the corpse, the corpse meditation or the skeleton meditation that is used as a nimitta. You can call it object, I was arguing with Adan Sujata, we should translate it as object of meditation, but he doesn't agree with that, because he says that there is no such thing as an object. That's probably true in the philosophical sense. So he translated it as subject of meditation instead, which is, I think, perfectly fine. So it's a subject of meditation. It is something you focus on, and then it develops through that focus. And it is a good foundation for immersion. Badako, samadhi nimitta is the Pali here. And why are these things a good foundation for immersion? Well, the reason why these things are specifically mentioned is because they tend to overcome desire. But remember that these things are very refined methods for overcoming desire. At this point, it is already assumed that your mindfulness has arisen. So all the coarse kind of desires that we have already been let go of a long time ago. What we're talking about here is very refined desires. Attachments to the body, attachments to the five senses, yeah? Things that are often invisible to us. Coarse desires, such as strong desires for the object of the five senses that we can feel in ordinary life, that is dealt with by sense restraint, not by this kind of method. And this is exactly the same thing with the 31 parts of the body. If you have strong sensual thoughts arising, 31 parts of the body is not really going to cut any, mustard. Why? Because it is too coarse. You need to deal with it in a broader way by using sense restraint and using some of the methods that we were talking about yesterday. This here is much more refined. So it is already a mind that is peaceful, a mind that is able to deal with these kind of perceptions. And then the underlying attachments to the body disappear because you look at the body in this way. And that then allows the samadhi to deepen. And eventually this then leads you all the way to the jhana state as a consequence. So that is the idea here. So, for example, if you use a skeleton meditation, a skeleton, you focus on the skeleton, and you realize the body is actually like this. So a skeleton is just kind of, it's neither attractive nor unattractive, it's just kind of this bunch of bones hanging together, the skeleton. But the skeleton also has the ability to transform into a samadhi nimitta proper. If you focus on the skeleton, you focus on the color, you single in maybe on a particular bone or a particular area, it can actually eventually turn into a profound samadhi object. And all of these things may, I don't know, I have never done these sort of things before, but presumably they can all turn into nimittas if you use them properly in this particular way. And this is how they're supposed to be used. But the most standard one is the skeleton, because that is well known to being an object that you can actually use for getting into samadhi. So you preserve that, you stay with that meditation object, you keep on with it, you don't allow it to disappear, and by staying with it, persevering with it, gradually it develops. And eventually it develops all the way until you get into the profound states of jhana or whatever. And this is how you take these objects and you develop them to their limit, so to speak. And that is what that is about. So, there you are. That's the four right efforts for you. If it may be that some of the things I have said may not be entirely clear, and if you have more interest in any of these specific areas, then please ask in the evening time, and then we can see if we can maybe make it more clear if there's anything that has not been quite right. That is all for now. At 3 o'clock, we will continue. We will move on to the four satipatthanas, the applications of mindfulness. So we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock. Yeah.